Thank you very much, David. And hi, y'all. I'm Julian Reinhart. I'm an alcoholic. It's just a real privilege to be here tonight, particularly in the capacity of Pacific Regional Trustee, and I do look upon that as privilege. I saw the name up here, but let me assure you that just the opportunity to be part of this assembly this weekend, and you're asking me to take part and to share with you this weekend, is the biggest welcome and tribute that you could pay, and I greatly appreciate the chance to be with you. I'm a member of the Mustard Seed Group in Las Vegas, and we do it the same way down there. One day at a time, we stay away from that first drink. I'm sober today because I have not had that first drink today, but more specifically, I have been graced with sobriety by a loving God that has expressed himself through this Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and many groups such as this one that's gathered here tonight. I can truthfully say that I am grateful to be an alcoholic. And I see some people going to cringe on that one. I did for a good number of years, and I know how you feel. But the reason I say it, and this is a realization that came about probably about 10 or 15 years ago, shortly after I moved to Las Vegas, was the realization that had it not been for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would not have anywhere near the life that I have today. I've been graced with sobriety, found a way to stay sober a day at a time, but more importantly, you people and many others before you have shown me how to live a day at a time. And that is a real joy and a real gift, and I'm very grateful. I introduced myself as an alcoholic. What does that mean? It doesn't sound all that bad, particularly in comparison to some of the labels that have been hung on me over the years. Matter of fact, alcoholic sounds kind of good in comparison to some of them. So I guess what it means is a person that cannot handle alcohol, yeah. And also, and that's the first step tells us, whose life has been unmanageable, possibly still is unmanageable. That's a realization that came about sometime after I had been in the program. But I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. What I'd like to do tonight is to share with you a little bit of my story, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and try to relate that to the opportunity that I've had in the last few years to be a part of service in this fellowship. And I guess that I don't want to go all the way back, and I'm not going to talk at any great length on any lengthy drunkologue. You can look at me. I used to say you could look at me and tell that I'm not too old, but that may be changing a little bit too. I came into this thing, and I thought that I was a little different than the rest of you, because at that time I was relatively young. I went to my first AA meeting in 1961, and at that time I was 24 years old. And in that particular room that night, I think that the next oldest person was about 15 years my senior. And I kind of used that as an excuse for a little while. Now, we've got a lot of people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous who have many years of continuous sobriety since the time they attended their first AA meeting. I'm not with that crowd. I'm with the PhDs, and they're pretty hard-headed drunks. It took me a four-year learning program to grasp a little bit about what was going on. I grew up, and you've already figured out also that I'm not a native of the West. I grew up a flatland southerner in North Carolina, and middle-class parents. I was an only child, spoiled brat, and that kind of set me up to start with. But they were good parents, and they tried hard. And if anything, if they had a fault, they probably tried too hard to be good parents. But their wayward son went to a dance one night when he was 14, and during the intermission, another fellow myself walked down to the local convenience store. We bought a bottle of Applejack and sociably drank it on the 10-minute walk back to the dance hall. It was a delightful dance. I had a grand time. And got home that night. I sneaked in without waking anybody up, and I thought all was well and good, and I was feeling just great. I laid down in the bed, and all of a sudden that ceiling started to spin. You know the feeling. And I made that mad dash, and I lost. I woke up the whole house. And I was heaving all over the bathroom, and my father came in, and he said, son, what have you been drinking? And I said, somebody put some wine in my Pepsi Cola. I mention that because three things happened that night. I had my first drink. I drank to excess. Secondly, it did something to me, in addition to making me sick. And thirdly, I told a lie. And these three characteristics followed me throughout the remainder of my drinking just about all the time. I got into as much trouble that night, though, that I decided that I would abstain for a little while. The folks thought that they would help me, and they decided that probably I was running around with the wrong crowd. So they sent me off to boarding school so I would not learn any bad habits. That has since been recognized as a gross error in judgment. But I stayed away from drinking until 1954, the summer of 1954, 1 week before I entered the University of North Carolina. My mother died of cancer, and it was a rather lengthy illness and a rather trying one on me. I tried to support her as much as I could during that period of time, but when I went to Chapel Hill, I guess probably the first or second night I was there, I had four beers at the local pub, and I didn't throw up this time. The next night I had six, and I didn't throw up. And alcohol seemed to do something. It seemed to make everything all right. And I guess that regardless of the problem with which I was faced in the years to come, it appeared, at least on the surface and at least at the start, that alcohol made things all right. And I leaned on the crutch very heavily. I was not an athlete. I was not a real scholar. At least it wasn't showing up on the grades. But they began to note that while some of the other people and other students would get sick, they would throw up, they would get in fights, they would wreck cars, they would say things that they were sorry for the next day. These things did not happen to me. And they complimented, people began to compliment me on my drinking. And I liked this. I had found something I could do well. I could drink. And I pursued it. I pursued it to the max. I really did. Without going into a lot of detail, let's just say that I kept drinking more. And what was a very subtle thing that slipped up on me, and I never became aware of until some years later, is the fact that very soon I was beginning to black out. And not until after I came into AA did I realize that not everyone who drank lost the last 3 hours of the evening. I was not stumbling drunk. I was not falling down. You could smell the alcohol on my breath, but it was not that noticeable. And I would be in a complete blackout. Or most of the time, I would be in a blackout. From 1954 until 1961, about the only thing that changed in my drinking was that steadily I've drank more and more and more. And I think it's just about an accurate statement to say that unless I was working, unless I was in class or asleep, I was drinking. Early morning, middle of the afternoon. If I had a commitment, I probably would not be drinking a few hours beforehand, but just about all of my waking hours, if I was not involved in something specific, such as class or work or something like that, I would be drinking. And it began to take its toll. I did not flunk out of the University of North Carolina. I left just in the nick of time. And I went into the Army, and I said that things would be different, and they were. For 2 years, I drank a great deal more. I wanted to see the world. I was single at that time. I wanted to go overseas. Some of my friends were going to Germany, and I wanted to go overseas. But I was shipped 200 miles away to Fort Jackson, South Carolina. I stayed there a year. They thought I was too far away, so they moved me to Fort Bragg, 65 miles from my hometown. Now, the significant point here is the fact that it never gave me a chance to cut the cord from the family to grow up. I was drawing enlisted pay, which was not much in those days. I would go through that in a short period of time, and then I would get the family to bail me out to give me money. I would lean on them. I would go home to pick up things on the weekend. Never really cut the cord. Never grew up. Got out of the service. Went back to the Chapel Hill. I said, this time it's going to be different. And it was. I busted out in 5 weeks. The drinking was totally out of control by this time. And what happened was that when I realized what had happened, I holed up in an apartment that I had rented and drank for about a week by myself with no one else. And this was the first real solitary drinking that I had resorted to, the escape, the total oblivion that became a very commonplace. Things got so hot around the house, I had to get out of the area because the folks were not happy. My father had remarried, and it was not a peaceful relationship with me and the family. So I went and took my first full-time job back in Northwest North Carolina. I was working for a finance company, and they gave me the glorious job of collector. Adjuster, they called it, but actually it was a collector. I did real well. I felt too badly to reason with anybody, and I got the money. And in the afternoons, I was too anxious to get back to work, to waste much time, and I got the job done. Problem is, I had trouble with their cars. I was running their cars off the road. Now, you can, in good weather, you can run one off the right-hand side of the road once or twice, and no other cars involved, no apparent reason, and you can come up with something. But when you start running over the left-hand side of the road, good weather, it gets a little rough in there. And I was having trouble with the finances. I was having trouble with checks. This is before the days of computers. Other people went to eat lunch during noon hour, and I went to banks. And I would write a check to cover the check that I had written the day before. My father was a banker. I had worked in the bank. I knew how the check system, the flow system worked. I also knew that if you went to a non-par bank, it'd take a week for the check to get around. And I would have this whole pyramid of checks outstanding with a very meager bank account or either an overdrawn bank account. And things would go along well until I got on a big drunk and it kind of erased it all from memory and I would lose track of what was where. And the telephone would start ringing at the office. And I would be trying to collect a bad check from one of our customers when on the other line there would be a bartender with one of my bad checks. And I can assure you that I talk more civilly to my customers than the bartender talked to me. It was an unmanageable situation. And they were also complaining about my absenteeism. I was missing Mondays. And I became my boss was complaining about my Seagram shaving lotion. And you have to recognize that I was in my early 20s then. I was 23, 24 years old. And I thought this was natural. So they were complaining about my Mondays. And as a matter of fact, they kind of put a bug in my ear. They had taken me off the road. They weren't going to let me drive any more of their cars. But they promoted me to loan manager and collection manager and so forth. So I stayed inside in the office. But the Mondays, I figured out. I had finally worked to the point that I could pick my own afternoon off during the course of the week. Most people wanted Friday afternoon so they could have a long weekend. Not Julian. I picked Monday afternoon. I figured anybody could tough it out for 4 hours. And then I'd go to my little tavern on the other side of town and taper off. And I'd taper off so well that I would miss Tuesday and Wednesday. So they fired me, but before they did, I had a girlfriend. I was not married, I was single. I had a lot of girlfriends. They're kind of short-lived relationships. This is one I had been with. She had been fairly tolerant, more tolerant than most. And she had a relative who was in the program who had been sober for a couple of years. And it was that traditional third-party 12-step call. And I'm sure that he would not have normally gone had it not been family making the request on him. And I don't know what she told him, but he came over with the literature, he sat down on the sofa, he made the pitch, so forth and so on, and he told me about a meeting that was going to be held the next night. And I thought to myself, well, he's probably for real, and if I'm going to stay in her good graces, I better go to that meeting. So I went to my first AA meeting. This was March 1961, and as I mentioned when I walked in, that most of the people there were considerably older than myself. The man who talked that night was on the top side of 65. And he talked about jails, DTs, lost jobs, lost families, the whole bit. And I thought to myself, he's very fortunate that he has that program. He needs it. 3 weeks later, I was fired from my first job. The pink slip said, unauthorized use of repossession. Well, what had happened was I had gotten drunk again. Taken a repossession, remember I was not supposed to drive their cars, and I had wrecked it, as I had wrecked two other of their cars. These were company cars. The repossession was one, actually it was stolen when I wrecked it. But I came on back, and about a week later, management got together, and they fired me. And they said unauthorized use of repossession. And in that denial that we're so good at, you know, I actually believe that that was the reason I was fired. That the $500 in bad checks that I had out, part of which were supposed to be payments from customers, the lost time, the wrecked automobiles, you know, they didn't have any bearing on it. It was this bad luck. Everybody did it. I just happened to get caught. They used these repossessions. And we need cars to drive. We took them out on the weekend. And that was my rationalization. Well, that was the start of 4 years in and out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. No fault of AA. It was Julian. But it was also quite 4 years. The exact figures are a little foggy, as you might imagine. During that period of time, I ended up in about 20 institutions, hospitals, drying out farms, missions, rehab centers, psycho wards, and a couple of trips to a state hospital. This four-year period of time. Also during that four-year period of time, altogether, from the time I was fired from my first job until I took a job which turned out later to be my career, I probably had about 20 jobs in there. I used to think that some of them were temporary. I felt more comfortable referring to them as temporary jobs. It was short. Actually, they were short, very short, sometimes 8 hours, sometimes 4 hours. I was not what one would refer to as a model employee. And I was having a lot of trouble with automobiles. There were some DUIs. There were several more accidents. No serious injuries, and for this I'm very grateful. But there were several DUIs. I had a judge that, it's kind of ironical because I was trying to get back to a state hospital to see if they would take me, and I was just out of my mind. And I was arrested by a sheriff's deputy. And the judge gave me a $100 fine, a year suspension of license, and 12 months on the roads, suspended on 3 years good behavior. On that part of the country, 12 months on the roads means 12 months on the roads. And this got my attention, not quite enough to get me to stop drinking, but it got my attention. During this four-year period of time, I don't know whether or not I was trying to catch up with you people, whether or not I was trying to qualify. If that was, you know, so I would have a story equal to yours. But if that was the case, I don't recommend that path. There is an easier, softer way, I can assure you. It was a rough 4 years. I ended up in DTs. They lasted altogether about 5 days, and I ended up the first time committed to a state institution. I stayed there for about a little over 6-8 weeks. I was discharged. Very soon I was drinking again. I had a relative who died, who left a small inheritance. And just like the proverbial drunken sailor, I went right through it. I'm glad that it was not larger. If it had been $5 more, I probably would not have lived. But that's just the way I reacted to money at the time. It was a long, hard path in there. Well, chances were running out, and I was physically getting in worse and worse shape. In April of 1965, I asked the state hospital at Butner, North Carolina, if they would take me back as a voluntary admission. I had been committed there with sheriff's deputies previously, and they said that they would. I had several $100 worth of bad checks out. I was unemployable. The family had kicked me out. My father had told me, he said, I asked him one time, I called him up from a payphone. I said, where am I going to go? What am I going to do? And probably the most painful words he has ever said is, I don't know, son. And he hung up, and that was it. So the state hospital said that they would take me back. I had been a patient there for about 30 days. And another patient myself arranged for a bootlegger to bring out 8 pints. And we got drunk out in the pine trees one afternoon. That was on May the 25th, 1965, and I hope that will be my last drink. Because what happened that afternoon was standard. I got drunk, I got sick, and I went back to my bunk in the room which I had, and a change started to occur at that point. As muddled as my mind was, and believe me, it was really scrambled. I don't know how it was possible for me to have the clarity of thought that I did. But I recognized exactly what my plight was and where I was and how close I was to an institutional life or death. That state hospital was a stopping off place to a corrections institution because I was headed in that direction. I had been arrested on numerous occasions. I had spent several nights in jail, but I had not served any time. And I recognized that I was at the end of the rope. I also recognized that these people had allowed me to come back. There were a lot of people that needed to be in that state hospital, but they had allowed me to come back. And I didn't even have the gratitude to try to stay sober. I went out and promoted another drunk, not only myself, but with other people. And I realized how senseless that this was. And then I thought about the 4 years that I had been going to AA meetings. During this four-year period, I did not drink and go to meetings at the same time. I would drink for 3 or 4 weeks, a month, come up for air, crash and burn, come back and go to meetings. 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks. It took me 3 years to get a red chip for 90 days. It was a very miserable existence, and I'm lucky. All of us who have been around for a while have witnessed people who went out just for a little weekend toot, a little short blast, and they never had a chance to get back. I'm lucky. I had the opportunity to come back. And if you fall in that category, you're very fortunate also. Because so many times we've seen those who went out did not make it back. This stuff kills people, and we've seen that time and time again. But I thought about these people in AA that I had met. And, you know, even though I was younger than the rest of you at that time, this was back in North Carolina. Now, down in Atlanta, there were a few younger people in the program. But at that time, there still weren't many around. Tom I was over in Raleigh. And he was one of the instrumental ones that gave me hope that maybe I could do it too. If he caught on at that age, maybe I could too. And I said, maybe if I go back and do what these people have done, maybe I too can find a way to stay sober. So I got out. I got in touch with one of the local AA members in Durham. He gave me a credit room at a 75-cent a night flop house. We had three dry AA members, a couple of practicing alcoholics, and a couple of junkies. It was quite a house full. And that's where I started out, 75 cents a night on credit. I started going back to the meetings, and I thought about these people that I hadn't met. I met people who really, I didn't know what they had, but I wanted it. There was an old fellow there who had had really some rough knocks since he'd come into the program. He'd been sober 10 or 12 years. He was about 60 years old. He had a son who had committed suicide. His wife was killed in a medical malpractice, and he'd had a bankruptcy. But he had an infectious personality. You could not stay in the same room with this individual and stay in a bad mood. He had the ability to give. Well, I didn't know that I wanted the ability to give, but I wanted what he had. He had something I wanted. And there were several of you. You people did not tell me how to get sober. You showed me by your example, by what you lived and what you did. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, maybe I can do the same thing. Started going back to one of the old meetings that I had attended. An old timer there said, Julian, incidentally, during this 4 year period, you guys did not give up on me. Now, you may have thought that he's too young, he hadn't had enough, he's not ready yet. You didn't tell me that. I walk in through those doors, you quit coddling me, you quit talking to me at 3 a.m. in the morning when I would call somebody, you quit coming by to see me, but you said, you know where we meet. We'll be there at 8 o'clock Tuesday night, or Friday night, or whenever the meeting was. And when I got to the door, the hand was out. And they said, Julian, let's try it again. The old timer was there, and he looked at me, square in the eye, and he said, Julian, your way does not seem to be working too well. Why don't you try it our way? And I had to agree with him. My track record was lousy. I had no defense. And I thought, I believe I will. And that's when I started my snooping program. I started picking out the ones that I thought were winners, those people who had something in this program that I wanted in particular. Now, I met some people who had quite a bit of sobriety, but not a whole lot of what I wanted. But I found a whole lot who had what I was after. And I started listening to them, what they said at meetings and what they did, what their program was, and asked them about their program. They talked with different languages because they came from different places. But they all said about the same thing. They said meetings, lots of meetings, 12 steps, all of them. They've got numbers on them for a reason, some of them even said. They talked about sponsorship. They talked about the big book. And this is what I tried. I tried to become a copycat, you know, bring the body and maybe the mind will follow. Been in that rooming house for about 6 weeks. A fellow that I had worked for previously said, "Gee, I'm starting something out in St. Louis. I think maybe you'll be interested." He knew that I was an alcoholic. I found out later, years later, that he knew exactly how bad a drunk I was, and he was genuinely trying to help me. And he took me out there, and it was a good job. It was, I was a franchiser, professional liar. And he didn't really know at that time that it was turning out in that direction. I was making good money, far more than I ever had before. And I tried it for a week, and it just began to null on me. Here was one of these coincidences, and their whole string of these coincidences that occurred in about a year that I can't look upon in my life, at least, as being coincidence. I finally just threw in a towel to myself, and I said, "I can't do this anymore." I went to a club there in St. Louis on Lindell Avenue, a big club at that time. I don't know if it's still there, but that used to be the Pinstripe Group. That afternoon, there was one person in that club. He was a salesman, and he listened to me, and he said, "Well, Julian," he said, "I think you know what the answer is, but if you want to try to make this program work for you, chances are you need to find another type of work." So I was, what am I going to tell my friend Paul? What am I going to tell Paul? So I finally screwed up my courage and said, "Paul, I'm going to have to move on." He said, "Julian, it's not working out for me either. Here's $100. Good luck to you, and let me know where you end up." And he accepted that. I took off on, put all my worldly possessions in the left-hand side of the back seat of my Volkswagen. I was able to drive in, well, they revoked my North Carolina driver's license, but I still had one in Florida, and that's where I was headed. I was going down to Florida to drive because I could legally drive in the state of Florida, and I took off, and I stopped off in Atlanta where I had worked previously. Ran across a fellow that I had worked with. He was working in one of the department stores there in Atlanta, and he said, "Listen," says, "looks like you're trying to get yourself straightened out for a change." He said, "I've got a garage apartment up here, and it's got a pull-down bed in the living room." Says, "Why don't you spend a day or two here? Why don't you stop over?" "Ah, Don, I'm going down to Florida. I've been drunk twice in Key West, both times with the inheritance money, short-lived as it was." And I said, "I'm going down to Florida." He said, "Why don't you stay over?" I said, "All right, I'll stay tonight." I stayed in Atlanta 5 years. I stayed with Don for about, 3 or 4 months. After about 30 days, look, I was 400 miles from home, and it still took me 30 days to get a job. But I found one, and I was working for a consulting telephone firm where I had some familiarity with what they were doing. And I was drawing. Well, actually, I was figuring cable counts. And this little woman across the table from me was drawing these maps. She would work weeks on these maps. And I put my clumsy paws on the map and write down the cable counts. And she would just go out of her gourd. And I don't know if she was trying to make amends or wise me up or what, but she invited me to dinner, and you people told me not to get emotionally involved for a year, and I listened just as well as the rest of you have. At 8 months, I got married. And it worked out. It worked out. It was amazing. It was also very important to me. I'd been there, and it was very important to me there to, I was going to the Skyline Group in Atlanta, and I found some real solid AA. And I was trying to follow this program as it was set down. And I was getting some good guidance. I was at the Buckhead Group there one night, and this old fellow with a heavy Boston accent came up to me. And he says, "Well," says, "I was about 26 years old when I came back the last go-around." And he didn't tell me how long he had been sober, but it was obvious the old goat no longer was 26 years old. And I said, "Ha, if he did it, maybe I could." So there was hope there. And I wanted to show some stability. I wanted to stay on this job for a little while. Maybe have a year put on that resume. A year, that'd be great. 1 year to the day they hired me, they fired me. And the reason was I could not get along with people. I was still just as neurotic as I could be. I was, you know, a high-pitched voice when I would get excited. I would overreact to everything. I was not functioning well with my fellow workers, paranoid as I could be. And the wife said, well, you've got a GI Bill and I've got a job. So why don't you go back to school and get that degree? And I said, all right. That was the easy way out. So I went back to school at Georgia State and they accepted me. Now, heretofore, I had majored in English, journalism. I'd moved around several times, as many people in that position do. I got down to Georgia State. Now, what is any self-respecting drunk going to study? Psychology. And I did. And I made good grades. I had a little bit of a different outlook on things. And I was studying hard and got a lot of support from my wife, Annette. Been in it for about a year. I was going to be a vocational rehab counselor and help alcoholics recover from alcoholism. I had it all planned. I was getting very uncomfortable. And I went to a social one night that made the Honor Society. My grades were doing well for change. And they invited me out to the social, and I looked around to the students that I was going to school with. And I looked at Annette, and I said, Annette, these people are weird. Now, when I was able to say somebody was weird, it was a significant statement. So I started thinking, why do I want to study psychology? And I started going into the fourth step and a repeated tenth step and the fourth again, just digging in there. And the answer I found was not pretty. You talk about a diseased ego. Actually, what I wanted to do was to go back to these institutions where I had been locked up as a patient and say, look, I'm cured. I'm well. I got the key now. The powerful one with a key. Not exactly what you would call a healthy, wholesome motivation. So with that, I went ahead and decided to change. I finished out the psych degree, but I focused on communication. Had my fifth birthday in Atlanta. I had graduated. I was not getting the job that I had hoped to get. I had made a lot of applications, hand-carried resumes. And here's another coincidence. 2 years this went by, I was working for the state doing a job that I really didn't care for a bit, but I was going to tough it out. An old federal office in Denver called a federal office in Atlanta and said, we need a water resource specialist. And the fellow says, we don't have one, but I know where an information officer is. He said, what's his name? We need one of those too. And they sent my resume in, and in December of 74, I moved from Atlanta to Denver. It was quite a change. I was truly out on my own. I had a lot of hesitation about exactly how well I could handle it. The wife was pregnant. We had previously lost one on a miscarriage. But I went ahead and we moved to Denver. Now in Atlanta, as I say, I had 5 years. I accumulated 5 years. And I was still ringy and dingy. But there was hope. I had been involved to a certain extent with some service obligations, not on a general service level. I'd been down there for about 90 days and was going to the NABA Club in Atlanta. And there was a men's stag group. It was a prestigious group. They all wore business suits to the 8 o'clock meeting. And I felt like I belonged. Somebody with my aspirations belonged there. They were looking for a secretary. And somebody said, I nominate Jillian for a secretary. And I just beamed from ear to ear like a mule eating sawbriars. And I thought to myself, wise choice. I'll do a good job. And about that time, a voice came out of the other side of the room and said, I'm going to do Julian a favor and withdraw his name from nomination. And I was just incensed. He did me a true favor. He did me a true favor. I was a coffee maker for the Skyline Group. I never will forget the night they gave me the key to the church. And I thought to myself, what if it burns down while I have the key? I'll be responsible. Well, I approached these obligations with a little reluctance, but 12-step work I was getting into a little bit. And I found out there was another dimension about 12-step work that I didn't understand. Only a few months into the program, we got a call at the club. One of the older members said, Julian, let's go out. We've got a man that's needing help out here. He said, he's about 60 years old. And I said, how in the world am I going to tell this man how to get sober? He's 60 years old. I'm 25 years old. I've been dry for a few weeks. And, you know, how am I going to be of any help? He says, you got a car, don't you? So that was my involvement there, and it was on a very meager level. I went to Denver and started a career with the federal government working.
Short time after I was there, I found out that I was really in over my head. I had some of the qualifications they were looking for, but not all of them. And I was very uncomfortable job-wise. The wife had a very serious medical problem. The child was dead at birth. At a premature delivery. And she was diagnosed as having a malignancy. And we were pretty much at a low point. Another coincidence that I can't overlook. I had accepted the job of coffee maker of a group there. Always made a point to get a home group and to relocate as quickly as possible and get established in AA, and I had done that here. And was coffee maker. I felt so badly that night, Annette was in the hospital, and I couldn't stand anymore. I didn't want to be around people. I felt so badly. I didn't want to talk to people. I hurt very badly. And what I'd done was to make arrangements with somebody. I think he snitched on me, but I made arrangements with somebody to take care of the coffee at the end of the meeting, and I was going to bug out and go home. And I was about ready to leave, and this old fellow walked up behind me and just, about 3 minutes later, have a seat. And he pulled me down like that. Man's name was Ralph, and for about 19 years, he was my sponsor. He latched on to me, as was his style. He saw I was hurting, I was in trouble. He saw me through that, and he went on to find another one, and that was his style. He died here a few years ago, but he gave a lot to a lot of people. And I became anchored there with a home group. Believe it or not, some people had asked me to sponsor them. And they were staying sober, but I learned from them. Sponsorship to me has been a very valuable part of this program. I cannot take credit for my own sobriety. I have been graced with sobriety, as I mentioned earlier. I certainly cannot take credit for anyone else's sobriety. But sponsorship, I think, provides a valuable two-way street in this program, at least it has for me. And in recent years, I think it's fair to say that I have received far more than I have given, though I've had the privilege to work with several. It's been a valuable part. But I called this guy up one night, and we had a 12-step call. I said, Dave, got a call down here, and this is Larimer Street in Denver, and as you know, that's not the better part of town, at least it was not then. And he said, it was snowing, and I had a four-wheel drive, and that's why they called me. And I said, Dave, do you want to go with me? And he says, no, but I think I better. And I learned from Dave. I learned a lot. Well, time for another relocation, Denver 4 years, turning into a federal gypsy and down to Yuma. Stay down there for 3 years, and that's where I entered general service as a GSR and a DCM. By this time, I had about 10 years of sobriety. And I went to my first general service meeting. It was in Phoenix, and it happened to be one of those choice ones. And the delegate down there, I remember I had known him earlier. And I saw him at one of the breaks, and I said, you know, so he had quite a bit of sobriety. He was a long old-timer. And I said, you know, I figured out why you guys keep coming back. And he said, why is that? And I said, you ain't well yet. Very evident. But it worked out. Stayed there 3 years, and I went to Washington, once again, still involved with the program. And each time I relocated, we left friends behind. We made new friends. We're very fortunate people in this fellowship. And you talk about a good underground network, you can't beat it. It's just amazing, the connections that you'll make in this fellowship, as you know. From Washington, stayed there a year and went to Boulder City, Nevada in 78. Very shortly, I was asked to go up to Tonopah. Somebody just wanted us to ride along for the weekend. They were a GSR. They wanted me to go along. I don't remember if it was that trip or shortly thereafter, I too became a GSR. And that was the start of an interesting experience. I was impressed with the group that I met up there. And it was a fairly sane assembly, much smaller than this group in those days, much smaller. But I went back the next year, and I continued to. I served as GSR, DCM. I'm firmly convinced that the GSR is the most important position in this service structure. And the reason being, the intent of the whole thing is to connect the member and the group with the general service structure. And the GSR is not there to be that link between the group and the individual member. The whole process is for naught. It's an important, a very important position. And then I found out a short time later that DCM was probably the most difficult, trying to keep track of these mavericks, particularly when they're not accustomed, and you're not accustomed. It was a real learning experience. Well, it's been an experience of love, because through that process, I, for the first time, gained an understanding of what love is, really. Became active in the different positions, state committee, area committee. And at the same time, I maintained my own recovery program. I think that service is an integral part of recovery. The two are very closely intertwined, one and the same, really. The purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers, and sometimes we are the suffering alcoholic. But as far as my own personal recovery program, I try to separate that. And like someone said this afternoon, you go to a group and they don't know what a GSR is, or DCM, or a delegate, much less a trustee. And you've got a refuge. You've got a place that you can sit back and soak it in and listen. The program that I have developed over the years is a very simple program. When I was down in Atlanta, another coincidence, there was a fellow visiting from out of town and needed to ride back to his motel. I had not been with him at the meeting that night. I had not been socializing with him. I don't know of anyone that I talked with whom he had talked. But just out of the clear blue, we've been riding down the road for about half a mile. It was relatively quiet. And he said, the spiritual part of this program is bugging you, isn't it? I said, it sure is. He says, do not look for it. Stay sober a day at a time. Go to the meetings. Try to work this program to the best of your ability, and it will find you. And in my own case, that has been true. I was not a churchy type of person. I was raised in the Southern Baptist Church, and I rebelled on that one. And I was not an atheist. I was not packing enough smarts to prove there was no God. So I was just kind of an agnostic, so be it, yeah. But after I had been there for a few months, I realized that I had not been kicked out, locked up, or strapped down anywhere. And I wanted to thank somebody. And I felt kind of funny. People told me that we have clay feet, don't thank an individual. And I felt very foolish thanking an entire group. So I said, thank you, God. And that was the start. Add to it the third and the seventh tradition prayers a short time later. And my prayers have not greatly expanded beyond that. I like to take out a period in the early morning to start off my day to remember whence I came. I didn't go into a detailed drunkologue tonight, but I think it's obvious I did not return the last go-around a high-bottom drunk. I like to remember from whence I came. It's been a long time since I thought about taking a drink. But today, I like to start off each day by reminding myself not to take a drink, that first drink, and to go from there. In this spiritual program that you people gave to me, you gave a tool that I had no concept of. I was an only child, a spoiled brat. I felt the world owed me a living, it was not paying off, and I was angry. And the word gratitude, I could not even spell, much less have any understanding of what it meant. And bit by bit, you showed me by your example. I found this is one of the, there are several things in this program that are very difficult to communicate verbally. But by living and showing, you get a grasp of what is involved. And this was the case here. And I found that I had a very powerful tool if I chose to use it. For resentment, anger, greed. I'm like a lot of drunks. I want it now. And with that, a little patience, a little time, over time came. It's been a very slow process. But what happened? Bit by bit, this self-serving, self-seeking, self-centered individual began to gain an awareness of other people and the fact that they have needs, they have feelings. And I became finding myself interested in other people, what they were doing, what they were feeling, how they were progressing with their program. It was a transformation. I had a lot of good sponsors along the way, some of whom were probably less than perfect models, but they helped me. They helped me tremendously. And I guess what I'm saying is that you do not have to be an exemplary member in this fellowship to be of great help to someone. It sure helps if you feed them the right information. Don't misunderstand me. But I've had a lot of help from a lot of people, a lot of places. A lot of people have contributed to my sobriety that don't even know it. And I'm sure you people have gone through the same thing. This fellow that I ran across in Atlanta that was 26 years old, I had the good fortune to see him about, I guess it's 5 years ago or so here. We had a PRASA here in Salt Lake City or down in Salt Lake City. And I was really anxious to reintroduce myself. Do you remember me? No, he didn't. Didn't focus the idea of who I was, you know. And how many times has that happened to us? Numerous times. You know that old saying that we may be the only copy of the big book that somebody reads today? Awful lot of truth in that. Think how many times people have come up to you and said, gee, you surely hit the nail on the head, or you described my situation. You gave me a lot of help the other night or last month or last year when you, what'd they say? You know, it's not important. You know, you tried to share, and apparently sometimes we connect and sometimes we don't. Well, let's take a look at the long haul in here. What happened? After 20-some jobs, I'd settled in on one with the federal government, and I learned in this program that you people also gave me a lot of tools that I could use in working with people, that my reactions were the ones that counted more than theirs. And I very frequently was mingling with those who did not love me. And I was able to take these principles and to put them into play in my work. They worked out very well. For someone who had been fired from a job but not able to get along with people, I just retired from a 25-year career involving intensive relations with people. And it was a good career, a very rewarding career. The relationships. I'd been in Las Vegas for just a few months and went to one of these meetings where they were talking about relationships, he in and she in and that stuff. And I made the comment, which was true, from the way I felt. When I came in, there were not many people my age. But I had said that I was single at that time, too. And I said if I'd come into this program when I was 72 years old, I'd have caught on right off the bat. About that time, a little white-haired old lady with a reddish tint in her hair stood up in the back of the room and she said, I'm 72 years old, and what are you implying by that remark? I answered her question with the only sensible answer, silence. I found out later she was from Utah. But I didn't really, you know, prior to coming into AA, I really didn't have much in the way of relationships. There were a string of short-lived affairs, whatever you want to call it. A one-night stand was a major commitment. I was just not doing well with people at all. I was not doing all that well with the male race either. You'll notice my nose has been rearranged several times. I was not able to communicate too well and to get along with people. But anyway, this past January, Annette and I celebrated our 28th anniversary. She's never seen me take a drink. There's no doubt in her mind, though, that I'm an alcoholic. She's not in Al-Anon, but she's very supportive of me. She goes to a lot of the open meetings. Not as many now as she used to in years past, but she's been very supportive. And we have a good understanding on this program, and it's helped us and our marriage tremendously over the years. I tell you people I'm an alcoholic, and you accept that statement as being fact. I had the good fortune to go back to Durham for a family reunion back in the western part of the state here about a month ago. So I went back to my old home group there in Durham, and they called on me, and I said, my name is Julian, so I'm an alcoholic. And in contrast to this room in here, there were about four heads in there. There's not a doubt in their mind. Not a doubt in their mind. I guess the most important thing, though, is that I came in here very ill-equipped for life and living. I was immature, spoiled brat. I had no plan for living. I was not really capable of coping with life as it comes down the road on a daily basis. That's what it boils down to. And you people gave me a way of living, a program to follow, and a way to live. As a result of that, I've been given a very wonderful life. I've been given many good opportunities. Probably more important than what I am able to be grateful for is the fact that I'm able to be grateful, because there, in my case, has been the healing. It has not been an overnight process, and I goof up with regularity. I identify myself verbally several times in the course of this talk as an alcoholic. Over the course of the weekend, I will identify myself non-verbally several times as an alcoholic. There will be no doubt in your mind by the time I leave. But that's the reason I say I'm grateful that I'm an alcoholic. I've been given a way of life that I would not have found otherwise. Had it not been for alcohol driving me down. There are two ways you can get this program, I think. One is you can get down on your knees of your own accord, or you can be driven down. I chose the latter. And in my own case, this was necessary, but I'm grateful that that occurred. I'm very grateful because I have received much as a result of it occurring. We were talking earlier on the panel tonight about, why service. One of the speakers talked about an opportunity to pay back a little bit. Maybe just in some small way, if we can pay back that with which we have been given. Somebody has to do this end of the work. And let's face it, it's work. Maybe not a lot of it. Some cases it is, some cases more than others. But it has to be done if this program is to function as it was given to us by Bill. He turned it over to the General Service Conference. And for that to work, the general service structure has to be viable. So we have an opportunity to contribute to that process. Now, my story is not all that unusual, because I'm sure that if we had the opportunity to listen to the stories of those of you in this room tonight, that we would have others with a long string of coincidences in their life. I don't choose to call them coincidences. I think this is a spiritual program, and this is the help from a higher power that I choose to call God. I don't go much further than that, much more specific. But I think as far as the individuals are concerned, it also applies to this fellowship. The only thing you have to do is to read some of the history of this fellowship. AA comes of age, Dr. Bob and the good old timers in particular. and look at the rough spots and the hurdles that this fellowship made it through and exists, not only exists today, but thrives today, it has to be a God-given program. You look at the short period of time that in which Bill put together that revision of the steps, you know, and what they have done for us, what was it, something like 30 minutes or so? We're very fortunate people. We're very fortunate to have this fellowship. And I find also in service that I meet a bunch of people that I just enjoy being a part of and associating with and running around with. One thing I noticed about Tonopah, and I'm sure that you see it here too, that you keep seeing the same faces coming back, and they're sober. They may be facing adversity. They may be having rough times, but they're able to cope with them. Not only are they able to cope with them, but they're able to give. They're the winners, and I like to be with the winners. As far as the fellowship itself is concerned, as I said, I do believe that this is very much a spiritual program, individually and fellowship-wise. The thing that is the strongest asset was one that was discussed here earlier, unity. Our strength is in the unity. Where else would you get such a divergent group of people as we have in this room tonight? All held together by a bond, our common welfare. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. How do we keep the unity? The traditions, the concepts, but probably more importantly, the traditions and the level of a group. Because if you don't maintain, I know that when I have had service problems, AA problems presented to me, nearly always they are the result of someone not being aware of a tradition, misunderstanding the tradition, or misapplying the tradition. And if the individual groups, individual members, have an understanding of those traditions, the value of the unity to us, the value of the anonymity and what anonymity really means in this fellowship will be not only more easily understood, but more clearly understood. Let it start on that level and filter on down into the other layers of the service structure. We've got some challenges ahead of us. And probably I look upon it as communication, and it's a two-way street among all levels of the service structure. We've got a challenge that's been presented to us in this sense. I've seen the change occur, and I'm sure that others here have. But think back of what we have has entered the scene as far as our service work is concerned in the last 10 to 15 years. First thing we had was the copy machine. And it used to be a major chore to get copies made. For a while, you typed them in carbon. Then if somebody had a copy machine, they cost a fortune, or you risk getting fired if you try to get one through the office, you know. So communications were fairly limited in the amount of paper that we could circulate. Then we had the computers. And people who could not write or would not write, they felt as though that their penmanship was too bad, that they couldn't write a straight sentence, and they would not write a letter, now have a computer. They write reams of letters and send them all over the country after they've made 20 copies of each. And the point is, we have a chance to get the word out, which is good some of the time if the information is correct. But if the information's wrong, we're in a mess, because we have all this misinformation out there, and then we have to really back up and start over again. Add to that the facsimile. You know, instant confusion. And I'll show them, I'll one-up them, I'll get it to them first. I'll show them who's got the information. Once again, if the information is correct, it's good, and if it's not. So we've got a challenge there, and I think at all levels, we're going to have to improve our communication skill to improve the openness. What I'm saying is to improve the trust level because that's the basis upon which we exist, trust and love. And still keeping in mind the one basic principle that we have, and that's to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. I thank you very much for the chance to visit with you tonight. It's good to have a chance to visit with old friends. Don and I served together. Patty rotated just before I came on. Gay's on board now. I've had an opportunity to meet many of you in the course of process and forums and so forth. Many of you I have not met, and I would like to get to know you this weekend. I've got a lousy memory. Forgive me if I stare at the badge. I hope your handwriting's good so I can read it. But I want to get to know you. I want to talk with you, and I invite you to chat with me. Thank you very much, and I appreciate the honor to be here.